made a point of knowing the details of their lives as well. That held true not only here, but at her residence in Albemarle and within the Hightower Keep that guarded the capital city. Daphne's mouth gaped when she saw Lady Rose, startled by her wild appearance, but after a brief hesitation, she curtsied.
"Milady."
Rose barely glanced at her, but her mind had already made several connections. Ordinarily, she would have asked after the girl's family, or if she was busy, she would have passed by with only a brief nod. Not today, though.
"Relax, Daphne. Your secret is safe with me."
Then she resumed walking.
"Idiot," Rose reprimanded herself. "Why did you say that? Now the poor girl will be stricken with anxiety the rest of the day."
She had let irritation get the best of her. Rose didn't care in the least that Daphne was heading to a secret assignation with one of the young men who worked in the kitchen.
"And yet I tormented her."
Most saw her as the perfect example of nobility, but Rose knew better. She was just as flawed as the rest of them.
"And entirely alone.
She'd been a widow for too many years, and now I've grown petty." For a moment, a man's face flickered through her mind, but as so often happened these days, it wasn't Dorian's. Ruthlessly, she pushed the image aside. She was far too disciplined to allow such things to distract her. The door to her empty apartment loomed in front of her. She entered and passed through the front room before stopping in the main living room. She felt restless and had no appetite for any of her usual pastimes. Often when she felt this way, she would travel to Albemarle. As the Lady Hightower, she had no shortage of duties to attend to there. Her title made her responsible for overseeing the protection of the capital city itself. But today she was trapped. Mordecai had left her in charge of Castle Cameron, and if she abandoned it, that would place the burden squarely on his underage daughter, Irene. Peter, the Chamberlain, was there to help if any serious need arose, but Rose wasn't about to leave Irene in that position without a good reason. She might be a Thornbear now, but she'd been raised a Hightower, and a Hightower never shirked their duty. An errant air current blew a stray bit of hair across her cheek. Annoyed, she brushed it back behind her ear. For a brief instant, she froze in place, but she resumed moving again almost immediately, crossing the room to check the hearth. Her eyes surreptitiously examined the room as she did so. The shutters that covered the lone window in the room were ajar, and the small table beneath it was sitting at an odd angle, no longer even with the wall. A flower vase that sat upon it had been shifted as well. Someone had entered the room while she'd been gone, and they'd probably come through the window. On its face, that fact was almost absurd. Her window was on the fourth floor and barely wide enough to accept any but a child or a very thin man. The wall outside would also be difficult to scale. Though it was constructed of stone, it wasn't rough. The available handholds would require a climber to have incredible finger strength.
They entered and either stumbled over the table or were forced to move it. Afterward, they tried to put everything back in place, she noted silently. Then they entered my bedroom.
She'd already observed that the door hadn't been firmly shut. The question that made her heart flutter with cold fear was whether they'd left.
Stay calm.
Her mind raced through possible scenarios. Theft, espionage, or assassination being the top three that presented themselves. She'd already discarded the notion that her maid had disturbed the room. Angela knew her habits and preferences well after years of service. After stirring the fire, she straightened back up and re-racked the andine. Though she was reluctant to release it, she didn't want to give away her hand if someone was watching her. Better to feign obliviousness. She had other weapons close by. She needed to get out of the apartment, but the only possible hiding place in the main room was the wardrobe, and it was positioned close to the door that led to the front waiting room.
I never should have placed it there, she thought regretfully.
Aloud, she said to herself,
it's still too chilly in here. Where did I leave my housecoat? Probably in the front room.
Then she moved purposefully toward the door. She hoped that if someone was in the wardrobe, they would wait for her to return before springing their trap. Assuming they did wait, she would simply leave through the main door and return with several large bodies to search the apartment. As she passed, the wardrobe door sprang open, and someone leapt toward her. Most of Rose's dresses had a hidden opening in the skirt, allowing her to reach a long knife strapped to her leg. She altered them herself if necessary. Already alerted, her hand was on the handle when her attacker emerged. Pulling it free, she brought the blade up at a low angle and drove all 9 inches of sharpened steel into the stranger's body just above the groin. She was momentarily shocked to see the stranger was a lithe young woman with short cropped hair and wearing men's trousers. Rose's second surprise came when the assassin didn't crumple or flinch from the pain of her wound. Instead, her attacker's hand dropped down to grip her wrist, preventing her from striking again. Rose screamed, deliberately pitching her voice to its highest volume. As empty as the keep was, it was unlikely anyone would hear her, but there was always that chance. Jerking backward, she tried to pull free of the invader's hold, but the woman's hand held onto her wrist with a grip of iron. Though the assassin was slender and small-boned, she was still taller and heavier than Rose. Awkwardly, the strange woman tried to slam her hand into Rose's head. Dropping low, Rose avoided the punch, while continuing to twist the knife still lodged in the woman's abdomen. As she went, she reached into her bodice and drew out her second weapon, a small stiletto, and drove it into the first available target, the assassin's knee. The strange woman fell forward on top of Rose, driving the knife even deeper into her own belly, and they struggled together on the floor. Blood was everywhere. Rose managed to keep her left hand holding the stiletto free. She stabbed again and again while the other woman scrabbled at the floor with her own free arm. Eventually, she managed to get free. Rose slid and almost fell, getting to her feet, for the floor was slick with dark blood. The woman was still trying to rise, to reach her, but she'd grown too weak to manage it. Then two hands gripped her shoulders from behind, pulling her backwards. Rose screamed again, and this time her cry was born purely of instinct and fear. Twisting, she pulled forward, but the hands had caught the neckline of her dress. The fabric gave way before she did, and she wound up tangled in her own clothing, her arms caught in the material that had previously covered her torso. She still held the stiletto, but it was impossible to bring it to bear. The new attacker was male, and inexorably he twisted her body around. When she resisted, he kicked her legs out from beneath her and followed her down to the floor, landing atop her. For a moment she thought he meant to rape her. Even as the nightmare unfolded, her mind had continued working. Neither of the two intruders had had weapons or sought to use any. It had to be rape, or possibly kidnapping, or both. Then as the man pulled his head away, she knew it wasn't rape. The look in his eyes was dead, empty. Not once had he glanced at her exposed chest. "Kidnapping, then," she thought. But something still didn't feel true about even that. As her assailant moved to secure his hold on her, she brought her knee up, slamming it into his groin. It had been a desperate measure, one she hadn't expected to work. Most men guarded their precious parts instinctively. This man simply ignored the move, and when her knee connected, he didn't flinch. One of his hands slipped behind her, grasping her unbound hair by the roots, jerking her head back at a painful angle. She gasped at the pain, and then his mouth opened as he leaned in to kiss her. Something metallic glinted within.
Gary stood quietly in Matthew's workshop. His eyes were closed, and his body in a low power mode meant to preserve energy. But his mind was active. It wasn't something he did when humans were around, for it only served to highlight his mechanical differences. If he had to rest in sight of humans, he would lie down and pretend to sleep. But Matthew didn't seem to care about his uncanny strangeness. Matthew was gone today, so there was little for him to do other than think. At least that was true until he began receiving the signal. The android opened his eyes and returned his body to normal function levels, listening in his own special way. There was a sense unique to him in this world, though he hadn't ever expected it to be useful here. There was nothing to hear. Until now. For all the apparent power and special senses that the mages of this world employed, none of them could have detected this. But what is it? He wondered. His higher functions had already turned the signal over to his multipoint computational unit, which in turn was running it through a variety of specialized signal algorithms. Thus far it was just noise, but it wasn't natural noise, it was highly organized and discrete. It was coming through on a low-frequency shortwave bandwidth. Almost too low for me to detect, he realized. Spreading his arms wide, he maximized the distance between his hands while applying a mirror repetition filter to the signal. It wasn't a perfect technique and could be prone to error, but it allowed him to simulate having a much longer antenna. The signal became stronger, but he could detect clipping at the edges. The distortion would make it impossible to decode even if he knew the encryption code. Then the signal ended. But who sent it, and who was it for? Pure deduction couldn't answer the question. A shortwave signal could cross vast distances, so the location of the intended recipient would be nearly impossible to determine. And without an active signal, as well as a much larger antenna, he couldn't know from what direction it had originated. It could easily have come from hundreds of miles away. Inductive reasoning produced significantly more information.
Based on his prior experience, he knew of only one entity likely to be on this world that would use such a signal. Ansys, the weaponized artificial intelligence he'd helped create in his home dimension. Matthew had already told him about its incursion here. The humans here had hoped it had been eliminated, but this signal proved that to be a false hope. Someone needed to be notified. But who? Matthew, along with his father and the rest of the ruling family here, were absent, except for one, Irene. Gary finished his analysis and decision-making in less than a fraction of a second. Moving to the door, he opened it and began walking toward the keep that was the heart of Castle Cameron. There was only one guard at the main entrance to the keep. The rest were probably stationed at the outer gatehouse. The man recognized him immediately, his body language broadcasting his unease at seeing the artificial man. Gary smiled to help alleviate the human's anxiety. "Excuse me, where is Irene Alunio? I have important news to relay to her." The guard looked at him suspiciously.
"You'll have to wait here. I don't think the Count would want you anywhere near his youngest while everyone else is gone. I'll send for the Chamberlain."
Gary decided that would be acceptable. The recipient of the signal was probably far from here. The humans wouldn't be able to react to the news in any meaningful time frame. And then he heard a new signal, this one on an entirely different wavelength, a high-frequency radio wave. This one could transfer information at a much higher rate, but only over short distances. Almost immediately, a second signal became active. Two Ansys units were talking to each other. Fortunately, the higher frequency and short range also meant he could detect the direction of the signal source. Taking quick steps, he walked a triangle in the yard, taking measurements at each point, then he triangulated the source location. "Roughly 50 feet above and to the left," he noted. "That put the source somewhere in the living areas used by some of the castle inhabitants. They're inside the castle." The matter was considerably more urgent than his first estimate. Returning to the guard, he spoke. "I am afraid that there is an enemy within the keep, probably the same one that the Count and his daughter faced in Dunbar. If we do not act quickly, I do not know what may happen." Those words got a more appropriate reaction. The guard stepped within and rang a bell, then he abandoned his post, running down the main hall. Gary took this as an invitation to enter. Guessing that the guard would be heading for Irene, he followed the man. Irene Alunio sat in the main hall, trying out her father's seat. It was unlikely she'd ever be countess, since she had two older blood siblings, but she couldn't help but have a fascination for the seat of authority. Besides, there was little else to do with everyone gone. Her closest friend Carissa was away in Albemarle. In short, Irene was bored. In theory, being left in charge sounded exciting, though both her parents and the Chamberlain Peter had made it clear that Lady Rose would be the actual arbiter of any important decisions. The reality, though, was that she'd been left behind with nothing to do and a babysitter to make sure that she didn't cause trouble. Irene let out a long sigh, wishing something, anything, would happen.
"Lady Irene!"
The doors at the end of the hall were flung back as one of the guards, the only guard in the keep, in fact, entered.
"What was his name?" she tried to remember. "Stevens, that was it."
Irene felt self-conscious at having been caught sitting in her father's seat, but she pushed the feeling aside and straightened her back.
"Yes, Guardsman Stevens, what's the problem?"
"Your brother's creature, the one they call Gary, is outside. He claims there are enemies in the keep."
The young lady's heart jumped in her chest. Excitement was one thing, and attack was something else. She still had nightmares of the day that she'd been kidnapped. Behind the guard, she could see Gary walking into the room. Stevens turned around, alarmed at the android's presence.
"I told you to stay outside."
Irene frowned. She hadn't particularly liked Stevens referring to Gary as her brother's creature, nor did she think his reaction now was appropriate.
"Stevens," she called out. "Stand down. Gary is a friend of mine as well. You should have let him in immediately."
Stevens bit his lip, but kept his sword sheathed. He didn't particularly like taking orders from a young girl, especially one whose judgment he doubted, but until Lady Rose appeared, he had no choice.
"Yes, milady, forgive me."
Irene addressed the machine man.
"Gary, what is this news of yours?"
Gary didn't waste time beating around the bush.
"Ansys is here. I can detect signals coming from two of their units above us and in that direction."
He pointed at the ceiling, angling his arm to the left.
"Given my readings since entering the building, I'm certain of their height now, which places them on the fourth level."
Irene froze. His statement terrified her. All too vividly, she remembered the assassins in her home, the fighting and the blood, the murder of Lily. What should she do? There were no guards other than Stevens. It would take 10 minutes or longer to recall the other four from the outer gate. Anything could happen in that time. Her hands began to tremble. Peter entered then, coming through one of the side doors.
What's going on?
This was her moment. Irene knew it. She had to say something, otherwise Peter would take over and she would be ushered off to some place the Chamberlain decided would be safe.
Peter, she said loudly, send for the guards at the gate. Have them meet us on the fourth floor.
Unsure of what was happening, Peter glanced at Stevens, but the guard merely gave a slight shrug.
Certainly, he answered. I'll send someone for them and follow you up.
Irene was already standing, though her knees felt weak. Marching forward, she headed for Stevens and Gary.
Let's go. Do I really mean that? I can't do this, she thought.
Her legs continued to move despite her doubts, however. The walls seemed to close in around her as they went, enclosing her in a dark tunnel. Something terrible waited for her at the end, and Irene's heart began to pound harder with each step. Deep down, she wanted nothing more than to stop, to turn away, to run. Gritting her teeth, she kept moving.
No, I have to face this.
Her hands were sweating by the time she reached the fourth floor. Gary led the way, and she was glad he couldn't see her face. She was sure her fear must be written across it.
It's this way, he told them.
Stevens sped up to walk in front of her as well, and from behind, Irene could hear steps on the stairwell. Glancing back, she saw Peter emerge. He was panting, and she guessed he'd probably been running to catch up after sending a messenger to the gate. The Chamberlain held a short mace in his hand. That should have comforted her. Irene had three defenders now, but the sight of the quiet Chamberlain grasping a weapon only served to highlight the gravity of the situation.
Gary stopped. This door. There and there.
Irene stared in horror at the door he'd chosen.
No, 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 no. Not this door. Not her. This can't be happening again.
That's Lady Rose's chambers, said Peter in alarm.
The guard tried the door handle, but it wouldn't move. The Chamberlain pushed his way forward.
Hang on, I have the keys for it.
Fumbling with his ring, Peter tried several, his anxiety and haste only serving to slow him down. When at last he got the right key in, he realized the door was already unlocked.
It isn't locked, he announced. Someone has barred it from the inside.
A heart-wrenching scream coming from within pierced their ears.
Get it open,
yelled Irene. Stevens threw himself against the door, but it was made of heavy oak bound with iron.
Get it open now!
Irene yelled again, her voice rising to a near hysterical pitch. Gary turned to her. These doors are too heavily constructed. Neither my body nor the guards has sufficient mass to break or dislodge the bar on the other side. Another scream came from within, a cry of desperation and fear. Irene stared at the door, and the world shrank around her until she could see nothing else. Her mind went blank, and the world vanished in a white blaze. When her vision returned, the door was gone, and everything was bathed in a strange golden light. Irene felt as though she was swimming. A dead woman lay in front of the door, but she hardly noticed her. Across the room and through a second door, she could see Rose on the floor, her dress covered in blood, while a man lay atop of her, twisting her head back at an odd angle. Irene's throat erupted with a shriek of rage and denial, and everything turned first red and then black. Her knees folded, but she never felt herself hit the floor.
Chapter 17. The forest around us was foreboding, but then again, when had anything in my life not been? I was certain I'd been born under some cursed star. With Penny on my right, Graham to my left, and Chad leading the rest of the men behind me, I felt well protected. Even so, I kept my senses tuned to the environment. Using my staff to clear the path was effective, but it still took time, time I used to make sure we didn't fall into another ambush. Now that I knew what to look for, I didn't think the spiders could surprise us again. Still, a dragon would have been nice. Dragons are always nice, as long as they're on your side. A quarter of an hour passed, and we crossed perhaps a third of the distance, when I sensed something new.
Something's coming, I warned the others. Two of them.
They were big, much bigger than the spiders, though nowhere close to the dragons in sheer size. I followed them with my mage sight as they ducked between the larger trees and smashed through the underbrush. They were roughly the size of very large brown bears, but they weren't furry. I pointed my staff in the direction they were coming from, and Graham and Penny moved forward and to the sides. Looking back at the men, I ordered, "Fan out. They're too big to hold with a defensive line. If they get past, you'll need to try and surround them."
"How big?"
asked Chad.
"I think they're the same thing you fought before, when you first came here," I told him. "Bear size."
The ranger nodded, and after a brief search, began climbing a tree. One of the soldiers shouted at the archer,
"Shouldn't you be down here with us?"
The hunter tapped the long knife strapped to his hip.
This ain't gonna be much use against something that big. It'll be easier to use my bow up here than if I'm down there getting my ass mauled.
The men looked nervously at one another, and I wondered if they might break and run. I had to do something.
Stand your ground, I commanded. Then I raised a wide shield between us and the direction the creatures would be coming from. I colored it blue to enable the soldiers to see it.
Penny and Graham were on the other side, and I hoped they would be up to the task.
The shield should protect you, but if Sir Graham or the Countess have trouble, I'll release it so you can back them up.
Penny gazed at me through the shimmering field for a moment, and our eyes met. Then she nodded and turned to face the dark woods. We'd come a long way over the years. In our early days, I'd never have allowed her to face such a thing without protest, even though it had often been her job. But I'd learned to respect her strength and resolve. We each had our part to play, and whatever happened, I'd be there to haul our ass out of the fire if these things were more dangerous than we expected. Had I made the right choice?
There was no more time to consider options, for the massive creatures were upon us, bursting from the underbrush and leaping toward me. Now that I could see them with my own eyes, they did indeed look bear-like. Stony skin covered massive shoulders and flanks. Their limbs ended in a multitude of glassy claws the size of meat cleavers. They roared as they came, ignoring the two warriors in front of them, and instead charging toward the middle of my shield, trying to reach me. An arrow sprouted from the shoulder of the one on the left, but it didn't seem to slow it in the least. Graham ducked under and brought Thorn up from below, cutting deeply into the side of its chest. The sword stuck there, and rather than struggle to free it, he bent his knees, dropping below a great sweeping paw. Then he stood and put his hands against the thing's shoulder. It looked almost like magic. Despite Graham's considerable strength, the beast outweighed him by at least an order of magnitude, yet he hardly seemed to exert himself when he pushed, toppling the monster over sideways. Penny wasn't quite so lucky. As the beast on her side charged toward my shield, she sidestepped and cut at its front leg, hoping to cripple it. Her lighter arming sword failed to cut deeply, though, and as she dodged out of the way, the beast crossed the remaining distance to slam into my shield. My defense held, but it was slipping. Something about the very nature of these creatures made them difficult to deal with using pure magic. The strain it put on my shield was far greater than it should have been, even for a creature of its size and mass. After the first shock of contact, it withdrew slightly, and then brought its claws to bear. In spite of my efforts, they tore through the shield as though they were enchanted. Unprepared, I felt the feedback from the shattered shield like a hammer blow to my mind. I swayed on my feet, and only by clinging to my staff was I able to remain standing. An arrow appeared in the beast's throat, and two of the men behind me stepped forward, stabbing at the monster, but it seemed to feel none of it. Standing on its hind legs, it towered over me like the shadow of death. Its massive forelimb swung forward in a sweeping attack that seemed certain to rip my head from my shoulders. And then Penny was back. Jumping in front of me, she stabbed upward with the point of her sword, catching the inside of the creature's foreleg and using its own momentum to help drive the point through. It screamed in rage and then dropped down to snap at her with its teeth. She should have moved. Her sword was trapped and the thing was just too damn big to face in a stand-up fight. But I was still behind her. Rather than move, she threw up her left arm to keep the massive jaws from reaching me. The monster's maw clamped down on her arm, encompassing it from just above her elbow all the way to her wrist. The deadly teeth weren't able to pierce her mail, but I heard her bones cracking as the jaw snapped shut. A tortured scream came from her as the beast jerked its head to one side, whipping her off her feet. My vision was clearing, and I saw two more arrows standing out from its shoulders. The rest of the soldiers were around it now, stabbing in at it with their swords. They didn't have the strength that Penny or Graham had, but their blades were enchanted, and given time I was sure the beast would die. But time was something my wife didn't have. Somehow she'd drawn her dagger with her right hand, but the beast that held her had begun shaking its head like a dog with a toy. Her body was thrown back and forth, and only the unyielding strength of the mail encasing her arm kept it from being ripped from her shoulder. Pushing through the pain in my head, I tried to grip the creature directly with my power to stop its violent thrashing, but it was like trying to hold a greased pig. Desperate, I used the air itself, pressing it inward, compressing it around the monster's skin. The dirt beneath it would have been better for the task, but I had no time. Air is a poor medium to try and hold something with, but I put everything I had into it until the air was as hard as steel, and it immobilized the beast holding Penny. Gritting my teeth and crying tears of rage, I continued to squeeze. There was a brief pause as the pressure mounted, and then the monster's chest collapsed inward. Its jaws opened, and Penny dropped to the ground as blood fountained from its mouth. The men were all around us, but I'd spared none of my attention for them. The only thing in my sight was Penny's crumpled form on the ground before me, her arm twisted across her body as though it was made of dough rather than bone and flesh. Her heart was beating. I could see her chest still rising as she breathed, though the pain had rendered her unconscious. Frantic to help her, I needed to remove her armor, but it would be a long and terrible process. The mail was twisted around her arm as well as her chest. Without thinking, I applied my power to it, ripping the welded and riveted links apart with thought alone. It shouldn't have been possible to do it that way. Enchanted mail is incredibly strong, and regular wizardry isn't normally up to such a task. If I'd been in my right mind, I would have used the rune channel in my staff to cut it, but I was beyond sanity. Yet the mail came apart like tissue under the force of my will. Beneath it, her flesh was a horror of blood, twisted flesh and shattered bone. Her arm was a ruin, nothing could salvage it, and her ribs and collarbone were broken as well. The skin across her chest was red and purple, and in places where the mail had been driven through the gambeson, it had been torn. My mind was blank, and my heart cold with fear, but I didn't hesitate. Reaching down with my right hand, I created a tightly focused line of gold fire at the tip of one finger, and used it to remove the tangled flesh that had once been her arm, cutting it off close to the shoulder. Then I sealed the artery and closed the skin. That done, I began reconstructing her ribs and collarbone, relieving the pressure on her lungs and internal organs. Minutes passed while I worked, moving quickly and efficiently to save her life. There were no words in my mind. It was an empty place that only had room for quick decisions and fast action. But eventually, there was nothing more I could do. And then reality came rushing in at me. Why didn't she have enchanted plate? If she'd been wearing the sort of armor I had on, the damage would have been far less. Why didn't I ever make any for her? I'd always meant to do so, but it was time-consuming. I'd been busy. There was always something more important to do. But I wasn't always busy. I could have made the time. I covered my face with my hands, hiding it from the men around me. Seconds ticked by. I could feel their eyes on me. I had to say something. I was in charge. They needed me to tell them what to do. But all I wanted to do was curl into a ball and die. Lifting my head and squaring my shoulders, I spoke to them. We'll hold this position until the dragons return. Sir Graham, you're in charge of the men while I attend to the Countess. Staring down at Penny, all I could do was watch her heart flutter in her chest. Her body had suffered a massive shock, but I'd done everything possible for now. My eyes kept drifting to where her arm had been. Stifling a silent scream, I pulled my eyes away. Don't look. Don't think about it. You have to keep it together. Everyone's counting on you, I told myself. Someone stood beside me, though I was too overwrought to recognize who it was at first. Then the figure spoke, and Chad Grayson's voice found my ears. Whatever you're thinking, it wasn't your fault. The urge to lash out, to strike him, was almost overwhelming. Shut the fuck up! He held out a hand toward me. Here. After a moment, I realized he was holding his flask. I took it and unscrewed the top. Whatever he had in it burned as I swallowed. The dragons are back, said one of the men loudly. Glancing up, I saw Grace and Cassandra descending, my son and daughter on their backs. I ignored their arrival, though I couldn't help but listen as Graham filled them in on everything that had happened over the past half hour. Mother! That was Moira running toward Penny, Matthew right behind her. I said nothing while they examined her with their own eyes and mage sight. Then Matthew put his silver hand on my shoulder. It was rare for him to seek physical contact, though perhaps he was only trying to remind me that losing a limb wasn't the end of the world. We'll make her a better one, he said quietly. Take her home, Ted. Moira and I can find Elaine. Something clicked inside me as I listened to his words. No, you take her home. Then I turned to Graham. Take the men back. Moira will teleport home with the Countess. Matthew and the dragons will stay with you until you reach the reserve force. Sir Graham's eyes flicked uncertainly toward Matthew as though seeking confirmation. Dad, broke in my son. No, you're in no state to do anything. Let us finish this. I'm the best equipped for this place. He was right, of course. My head was still tender from the feedback, though it wasn't nearly as bad as what I'd experienced in the past. I was functional, but my emotional state was in disarray. I also didn't give a damn. I'm not risking any more of my family today. Do as I say. Graham nodded. Yes, my lord. Matthew wasn't having it, though. You aren't the only one with family at risk here. Do the smart thing and go home. Moira stood beside him, clearly agreeing with him. I've made up my mind, I told them. Moira started to speak. Dad, this is insane. Listen to him. Grinding my teeth, I ordered them once more. Do as I say. Both of my children looked to me as if I'd lost my mind. Perhaps I had, but mad or not, I was certain no one else would be hurt. I turned away and began to walk in the direction I'd last sensed Elaine's aether. I'll see you when I get home. As I walked, I heard Chad's voice behind me, speaking to Matthew and Moira.
Ease up. He'll not listen to you. I've seen that look before. Best we get out of this damn forest as quickly as we can.
I left them there, and since I was now alone, I didn't bother cutting a path. Instead, I saw relief from the pain in my head by slipping into the mind of the stone. In the years since my abilities had first awakened, it had gotten easier. Opening myself to the world around me, I became more than what I'd been, a larger entity that encompassed some of my environment while retaining the majority of my humanity. It was like walking a tightrope, but with practice, balancing had become second nature. Language was still possible. I kept my ability to reason, but my emotions were distant. The ground beneath my feet was a part of me, as was the air I breathed. The trick was keeping my focus on the fragile human body in the middle of it all. The aching in my head was still there, but it was a thing too far away to hurt me. Branches and limbs bent and swayed, pulling aside to let me pass. In the mind of the stone, there was no physical danger that could touch me, only the constant danger that any archmage faces, the risk of losing himself. I continued toward my goal, letting the world slip past. I felt as though I moved without walking, though I was quite aware of my legs taking steps beneath me. The truth was more that the world ahead became me, while what was behind passed into the land of the other, that which was no longer me. How long I walked was a mystery, for time had little meaning. Things moved in the shadows, some large and some small. For those that entered my domain, I had no mercy. Rather than allow them to join me, my body moved to destroy them. Vines and underbrush strangled the smaller creatures, and when the larger ones came, the trees themselves tore them apart. I remained untouched as the world passed beneath my feet, changing to become the place I'd set as my goal. A light flared before me, not a light of the eyes, but of the spirit. There was a space, an opening beneath one of the great trees, and within was a creature burning with life and vitality. For a moment I considered destroying it as well, but then I recognized it. Blonde filaments floated around its head. "Hair," supplied the voice in the back of my mind. "This is Elaine." Death hung close to it, a dark shadow that would not be dispelled despite the creature's fierce life force. It spoke to me, and at first I failed to comprehend it.
"Mordecai," it repeated.
No, she repeated. Elaine was a woman. A human being. Like me. "Elaine," I asked. She looked at me strangely.
"Yes, Elaine. Snap out of it. Help me."
At last, my mind collapsed like a bubble breaking. My thoughts fell inward and the world shifted. I stood deep within the depths of the forest. I'd found Elaine huddling in a small cave-like place under a tree. There was a man with her. I hadn't registered his presence before, probably because he was already dead, his body beginning to decompose. He was one of the soldiers who'd entered with Elaine and her father, Walter.
"Get inside," she told me, urgency in her voice. "If you stand out here long, more of them will come."
I stepped in, and darkness enveloped us, a veil of invisibility blocking both visible light and aether. I could still see Elaine within the veil, but only with my mage sight. "Is there anyone else?" I asked her. "Your father?"
"Dead,"
she answered, in a voice numb with fatigue. Elaine looked gaunt and drawn, with dark circles under her eyes. Her skin seemed tight, stretched across her features and frame.
"He drew them off, so Brent and I could hide."
Brent, I assumed, was represented by the body of the soldier at the back of her hiding place. He smelled bad, but there was no sign of bloat yet. A small hole in his abdomen explained that, though if it was the result of an injury or whether she'd done it herself, I had no way of knowing. Now was not the time to ask. His body was partly covered with loose soil and leaves. Judging by the black dirt beneath Elaine's nails, it looked as though she'd been trying to bury him using only her hands. That made little sense. She could have accomplished the task much quicker with her power.
Her arms went around my armored chest, despite the fact that hugging a man in plate armor wasn't a pleasant thing.
"Where are the others?" she asked. "Are you alone?"
"I sent them back. Penny was injured, and we'd lost a number of soldiers." She released me and sank to her knees.
"So you're trapped too? Do you have any food?"
"Trapped? No. I came to take you home," I told her. Her face changed at those words, new hope replacing the despair in her eyes. I still didn't understand everything, though. "Why didn't you teleport back?" Elaine looked down.
"I couldn't remember the keys. I had them written down, but I lost my belt and pouch during the chaos of the first attack."
I sighed. "I made you memorize them when you were a student. How could you forget?"
"That was years ago. Some things get fuzzy with time."
"Then you should review them," I said, regretting the harsh tone in my voice almost immediately. My own recent failure to protect Penny had left me bitter, and it was coloring my reactions. Unlike Matthew and me, other people didn't have perfect recall. It was easy enough for me to judge, but reviewing details like that was something I never had to do. "I'm sorry," I said quickly. "This is not the time. I'm tired and upset myself." Now that I was no longer in the mind of the stone, my head throbbed, but I ignored it and used my power to clear away a level place in the middle of her hideaway. Anxiety gripped Elaine, and she warned me,
"Careful, any use of power draws them.
They can't see our Aether inside this veil of yours." She shook her head.
"It doesn't matter, even the veil draws them. They sense the Aether it uses, even if they can't see exactly where we are. Too much power and you'll draw a lot of them. Eventually one will stumble into the entrance."
"What have you been doing all this time?"
"I kept my mind closed, my Aether damped down as much as possible. I only used the veil when I heard something getting close. Dad and I hid the first day using veils, along with poor Brent here. But they kept finding us. Dad finally figured out it was the diffuse Aether of our veil that they were homing in on. But it was too late. When the wolves found us, he ran, drawing them away."
Walter killed by some kind of strange wolf. It was hard to believe. Elaine went on.
"I think he killed the wolf somehow. I saw him coming back, but the spiders caught him."
She stopped briefly, her throat struggling to say the words.
"I saw everything."
I felt sympathy for her, but even that emotion was blunted. "You say them, but what do you mean exactly? The bears, or something else?" I asked.
"All of them," she answered. "The bear things, the spiders, the wolves, there are even large serpents that hunt in this forest. All of them are drawn to any significant amount of Aether."
Then she pointed at me.
"Right now you're drawing them to us. That's why I put the veil back up, but if you don't close your mind, seal your Aether inside yourself, they'll find us eventually."
A noise outside caught our attention, leaves rustling beneath heavy feet. Elaine seemed to crumple, shrinking back toward the back wall of her hiding place. She motioned toward me with her hands, begging me to come with her. "We have to make a circle," I told her, refusing to lower my voice. "Get started. I'll deal with this."
"Magic doesn't work,"
she began, her voice almost a whisper.
"You have to use something else."
I nodded. "I know. Rocks, dirt, whatever's close to hand. Start the circle. I'll finish it and add the keys when I get back." Stepping back through the veil, the shadowy light of the forest floor was still bright enough to almost blind me. Luckily, my mage sight didn't suffer the same problem, for standing not 10 feet away was a giant man. Well, man wasn't really an appropriate description, but it was humanoid. Covered in pebbly gray skin and standing somewhere close to 15 feet in height, it had 2 arms and 2 legs, though they were twisted and lumpy compared to human proportions. The head that sat on its shoulders was thick and short, with almost no neck, and it was crowned by a massive black horn in the center of its forehead. "Damn, you're ugly," I muttered. Looking at the horn, I felt sorry for the mother that had birthed it. Then again, I realized on second thought that the horn had probably grown in later. Chapter 18. The ogre and I stared at each other for a second. I thought of it as an ogre because I had no idea what else to call it. It certainly looked like a monster from some demented writer's fairy tale. Since I was no longer in the mind of the stone, I couldn't expect my surroundings to deal with it for me, but I had plenty of other options. Plus, I was still dealing with a lot of pent-up anger and self-loathing. The ogre twisted at the hips, whipping the massive club it had been dragging behind it into the air and swinging it toward me with one large, lumpy arm. Perfect. I didn't bother directing my power at the monster, since it likely had the same protection all the creatures here had. Instead, I seized its club, which was in fact a moderately sized tree that appeared to have been recently uprooted and trimmed of its upper limbs. My iron will and seething power gripped the club, stopping it only a foot from my still tender head. Then I wrenched it around in the air, which sent its former wielder flying into the nearby bushes. It roared with rage, and seconds later it was back, covered in twigs and leaves. I met its call with the rooted end of the club, driving it into the ogre's head like a battering ram. "It's time to improve your looks," I muttered. And then I beat it to death. There was nothing glorious or romantic about it. It couldn't even be called a battle. The ogre never had a chance. The first blow had stunned it, and after that it was just a brutal succession of hammer blows while I smashed its body into a twitching pile of flesh and broken bones. Even furious as I was, the sight of what I did made me sick. Finished, I placed the club in front of the entrance to Elaine's hiding place in case I needed it again, and as I walked inside, I couldn't hide from one particular thought. If I'd done that earlier, rather than rely on Penny and Graham, my stomach knotted within me. Elaine had the circle half done. I finished the rest and added the destination key before doing a calculation to assign the present location key. Once that was done, we returned to Castle Cameron, taking Brent's body with us. It would do him no good, but at least we could give him a decent burial, unlike poor Walter. Matthew, Moira, and Connell were there ahead of us, having brought Penny back via a similar temporary circle as soon as they'd left the forest. The others were still on the road with the soldiers. Moira and Connell embraced Elaine while Matthew looked on. He wasn't one to give hugs when they could be avoided, but as his siblings had released her, she reached out and pulled him in anyway. From my vantage point, he looked uncomfortable. But then the dam finally broke within Elaine, and her shoulders began to shake. Matthew's face softened, and he held her tightly while she cried. Moira looked at me, mouthing Walter's name in a silent question. Bowing my head, I answered with a negative nod. Leaving Elaine in their care, I found Peter, my chamberlain, waiting for me. I directed him to Brent's body, which we'd left outside. Send word to his family, and have him prepared for a hero's funeral. Peter started to speak.
My lord, I have—
Ignoring him, I asked Connell anxiously, Where's Penny?
The man just took her upstairs. She should be in bed by now, he replied. At least went with her.
I started for the stairs, but Matthew called out to me.
Hey, old man.
That brought a frown to my face.
What?
Don't do that again. I don't want to be count any time soon.
Oh, really? You should be so lucky, I told him.
He nodded.
Really? It seems like a very inconvenient job. I have better things to do with my time.
Then he grinned. I hadn't thought about the matter in a long time. I had been declared dead once before, and Penny had held the title in my stead, but she wasn't a Cameron by blood. She could only hold it until one of the heirs was of age. If I died, it would have fallen to him. Connell and Irene were in line after him, since Moira was adopted and not my natural-born child.
You'd better use your time well, then, I said. One of these days it will be your turn, whether you like it or not.
Peter spoke up once more.
My lord, things have not been quiet here. I have bad news.
I was in no mood. I needed to be with my wife. Haven't you already told them? I asked, waving my hand toward Matthew and the others. The chamberlain shook his head.
They arrived only moments before you did, and with the countess in such a state, I haven't had the chance.
Whatever it is, it can wait, I began.
It's Lady Rose and your daughter Irene, interrupted Peter. There were intruders in the castle.
What? How? Are they all right? I rounded on the chamberlain with something approaching panic.
Lady Rose was rather shaken, and Irene, I'm not sure what happened. She's asleep now. Gary understands more of what happened, but I'll give you the details of what I know.
I listened for several minutes, and then headed for home. How is she? I asked Elise. The old woman looked at me with tired eyes.
First you, now her. I'm convinced you two are trying to work me to death before my time. She's breathing, and you seem to have done a good job with her bones. I can't tell if there are more serious internal injuries, though. I don't have your sight.
She isn't bleeding inside, I told her. Everything is in its place, except her. I stopped, unable to say the words. Except her arm, I thought. Elise got up from her stool at the bedside and wrapped her thin arms around me.
You did well, Mort. If you hadn't removed the arm immediately, she would have died. Don't blame yourself for it.
I'm going to fix it, I said suddenly, firming up my conviction. She misunderstood me.
I'm sure Matthew can build her an arm that will be better than the original.
I stepped away from her. No, I mean I'm going to restore it. Elise frowned.
Can you do that? I thought your unique form of healing was limited to yourself.
It was, if the Archmage attempting it was sane. But I'd done it twice before, once when Penny had nearly died after being struck by a ballista bolt meant for me, and once when Elaine had been near death years before. That was something I'd never intended to do again. Using metamagic to become another human being essentially resulted in a merging of souls. It held a risk unlike that of becoming earth or wind, but no less dangerous. Separating again was difficult, and afterwards you could never be sure who you'd been originally, the healer or the patient. I still wondered occasionally if I was really Elaine, and whether she was walking around with my soul instead of her own. There was no way to know. But for Penny, any risk was worth it. And if I had to become another person, there was no one else I would rather be. I feel a little sorry for her, though, I thought. I wouldn't wish being me on anyone. In answer to her question, I nodded. I can. I'll wait until she's recovered, though. Elise's eyes narrowed.
Is it safe?
Certainly, I lied, before changing the subject. What was your impression of Irene? She threw up her hands.
What do I know of magic? Her body is whole, but I couldn't wake her. Whatever she did sent her into a comatose state.
It was obvious that Irene's power had finally awoken, and if her body was unhurt, I was fairly certain she would be fine. It went differently for everyone, and usually occurred sometime after puberty, and often during a moment of stress. With me it had happened around 16, to save a friend's horse from drowning. At least Irene, unlike me, would have plenty of people to help her learn and adjust to her new abilities. A splashing sound from the adjacent room drew my attention. I did my best to ignore it. After they'd settled Irene's unconscious form into her bed, Elise had brought her daughter-in-law to my room to use the bath. Nearly alone, the old healer had had a lot of patients to look after, and they hadn't expected me to return so soon. Most of the bedrooms in my hidden mountain home were warded for privacy, but the large bath that Penny and I shared was warded with our bedroom, which meant it was entirely open to view with my mage sight while I remained by Penny's bedside. A natural question to ask would be why did it matter? In my everyday life, I dealt with people constantly, and clothing was no more of a barrier to mage sight than walls were. I and my children were all accustomed to that. For myself, I usually just tuned it out. Peering through clothing and searching out the shape and form of other people's bodies gets old quickly when it's part of your everyday life. Also, it wasn't quite like sight. There was no color, only form. For example, in a pitch-black room, I couldn't read a book. I could detect its shape, look at the pages, but the writing was not easily apparent unless it was writing imbued with aether. I could potentially read it, but only by focusing intently on it, inch by inch, to detect the difference in places where ink was present and where it wasn't, but such a thing would take forever. Similarly, examining people's skin beneath their clothing didn't reveal too much more. Usually their general shape was already apparent from the lay of the cloth anyway. A woman bathing nearby, though, was a little different, though it was mainly a psychological thing. Fortunately, I developed a lot of discipline, and age and maturity helped as well. I couldn't help but see a bit, but the main thing was to keep my attention focused on other things closer at hand. One other point, while aether doesn't show true color, that doesn't mean it doesn't present other information to the mind beyond simple form. The problem is that the human brain wasn't designed with this extra method of perception in mind, so it borrowed from our experience of the other senses to interpret what was observed. The aether of individuals was unique, and the mage's mind often presented that difference as a taste, a scent, or a color. Through long association, I could easily identify the aether of my friends and family. Someone like Rose, whom I'd known for well over 20 years now, was no exception. Not being a mage, her aether was far dimmer, and it clung closely to her body. To my mind, it possessed a pleasant scent, and it was entirely feminine. At times like this, as she stretched and stood to rise from the bath, it rippled across her skin, highlighting the shape of... God damn it, I said out loud.
What is it?
Asked Elise, looking at me strangely. Leaning over, I kissed Penny's sleeping face. Standing, I took a few steps and then answered her. Nothing. I just need to go and check on Irene for a while. It was a relief when the door shut behind me, and with it the ward. Irene was unchanged.
I'd been in her room only a short while before to look in on her before checking Penny. I hadn't really expected to find anything changed yet. She still lay quietly, her breathing and heart steady. Most importantly, her aethar seemed intact, though it was still turbulent. She would probably be nauseous when she awakened. A knock came at the door, and then Matthew entered without waiting for me to answer. Gary stood behind him in the hall.
Dad, we need to talk.
What have you learned?
Quite a lot, actually. Gary's been able to give me some important insights.
He didn't finish the sentence, for another voice interrupted him.
I hope you gentlemen weren't planning on having this discussion without me.
Lady Rose stood in the hallway, her hair in a towel and clad in one of Penny's nightgowns. The garment was entirely too large for her. You should probably rest, I argued. You've been through an ordeal, Rose.
She nodded. I couldn't agree more. I don't enjoy being attacked, and having to wash that much blood out of my hair was almost as unpleasant. Nevertheless, before I sleep, I'd like to know the meaning of it, otherwise I won't be able to rest.
Gary spoke up.
Actually, it would be helpful to have your account of what happened before we arrived.
Since they were all making sense, I agreed, and we adjourned to the living room. Chapter 19 Rose followed the others, and I was behind her. Before entering the main room, though, she turned back toward me.
I need something, Mort. Just a moment, if you don't mind.
Matthew looked at me questioningly, but I waved him on. I'll be right there. Lady Rose smiled at him, and after a second, we were somewhat alone. Rose turned to me and looked up.
I am not well.
Concerned, I asked, what's wrong? Then her facade cracked, and her face twisted. Burying her head against my chest, she threw her arms around my waist and held on tightly. I hugged back, worried. Rose was a woman of famous self-control. In the 20-plus years I'd known her, I'd only seen her like this on a couple of occasions. She wasn't crying, but I could feel a tremor in her shoulders, and a strangled noise came from her throat. She was screaming silently into my chest. After a minute, she took a deep breath and released me, composing her face and wiping at her eyes with the sleeve of the nightgown.
How do I look? She asked me.
I gave her a once-over and made my pronouncement with a wink. Better than me, as usual. She nodded, making a brave face.
Thank you, Mordecai.
Then she turned toward the living room. I followed her in. Don't thank me, Rose. That's what family is for. After that, she found Alyssa and set her making tea for us. Then we all settled in and got comfortable. Connell walked in before we could start. What's going on? Matthew looked at his younger brother with frustration. But after a moment, he sighed and answered, Actually, go find the others. We may as well do this once so everyone can share what they know. Connell left, and a few minutes later, he returned with Graham, Moira, Elaine, and Linarala. There weren't quite enough seats, but that was a common problem in our house, which was why we had an abundance of cushions. Elaine took the last chair, while Moira, Linarala, Graham, and Connell made themselves comfortable on the floor. Matthew addressed the room. I'll start, since I think Gary and I have the most to add. Leaning over, he waved his hand at the android. Gary can detect Ansys. He can hear their means of communicating with one another. That produced a stir in the room. Matthew went on. He can detect types of light that are invisible to us. One type he detected today is used for long-distance communication, but it generally requires a long piece of metal called an antenna to be used. He also detected a different type of communication that is faster, but only effective over shorter distances of 100 feet or so. That was why he led Irene to Rose's room. Elaine spoke up.
Did you say this was a type of light?
Gary answered her. It is, and before you ask, yes, your invisibility veil blocks it. When you went to my world with Karen and Matthew, that was why I had to have you open holes in your veil, so I could communicate.
She nodded. I just wanted to be sure.
Matthew smiled. What Elaine is considering is an important point. The Prathean abilities could conceivably be used to block or interfere with Ansys's ability to communicate. With her and her brother George's talent and the judicious use of specialized enchantments, we could create areas that prevent them from communicating. Linarala broke in.
If you can use the short-range signals to locate them, can you also use the long-range signals to discover where they're hiding?
Gary answered. Yes and no. It is possible, but I'm barely able to detect those signals at all, given the size of my physical body. Also, because of the potential distances, accurate triangulation would require me to measure the signal from at least 3 separate locations simultaneously. Those locations would need to be separated from one another by a significant distance. We would have to build antennae in different cities and find some way for me to connect them all at the same time to monitor for the signal.
If you can hear them, what are they saying? If they don't know anyone can listen, they might give away their secrets, said Connell.
Encryption, said Gary. Before he could launch into an explanation, Matthew interrupted.
I'll explain that to you later, Connell. The important thing is that their messages use a code that we can't break.
I'd like to know why they were targeting my mother, said Graham.
Rose sighed. That's obvious enough, son.
Graham shook his head. No, it isn't. Sure, you're important to me, and you're important to Lothian, but we're dealing with machines from some foreign dimension. Why would they be interested in you?
Strategy and tactics are always based on similar principles, no matter what the nature of the mind behind them,
explained Lady Rose.
In this case, they wanted eyes inside the castle, and they sought to implant one of their metal bugs into me for that purpose. They couldn't target Irene because she was too close to Mordecai. Moira has already shown them that wizards are capable of detecting their presence in human hosts. They wanted someone important enough to learn valuable information, but far enough away from the Count's family to avoid detection.
I watched Rose carefully as she spoke, and as usual I couldn't help but be impressed at her objective calm as she discussed the possibility of her own body being used as a host for the enemy's body-controlling machines. I also noticed that she tucked her hands into her sleeves to hide her trembling. Moira spoke then.
I don't understand how this connects to what happened to Lancaster. None of it makes sense.
I looked at Linarala, my gaze steady as I spoke. It doesn't. I think we're dealing with 2 completely separate events. Linarala met my gaze without flinching. If anything, there was a question in her eyes. I honestly didn't think she knew anything, but if she did have any guilty thoughts, I didn't want to miss the signs. Moira frowned.
Why are you looking at her?
I believe the Illinial Shi'ha are responsible for what happened at Lancaster, I responded. Then I let my eyes move to Moira's face. But I have no idea how or why. That statement produced another commotion as everyone began asking questions at once, questions we had no answers to. Eventually, Matthew got control of the conversation again.
He's right. What I sensed at Lancaster was definitely translation magic, and the hexagonal shape of the land that shifted was a likely indicator that it was done with spell weaving. The problem is that we don't know of any current Shi'ha with the numbers or power to do something that large.
Could there be some hidden group neither of you know about? Asked Rose.
Doubtful, I answered. And it had to be a lineal Shi'ha, only they have the gift to accomplish it. Linarala asked the question everyone was wondering.
Do you think it was my parents?
Cantirian Spellweave, I asked. How long has he been in human form?
Only a few weeks, she replied. He was still an elder when I returned to the grove. As an elder he could spellweave, but as a human I have not seen him do so.
So it could have been him, said Connell. He had time to travel to Lancaster. How did your mother react to him abandoning the grove? I asked simultaneously. Linarala answered carefully.
He never left while I was there, and though he took human form, his elder body remains. It still provides pollen for mother's flowers, but it has no mind while he is apart from it. I do not think he could have done this.
As much as I wanted to blame her murderous, psychopathic father, I was inclined to agree with her. Which left what? We're going in circles, I said at last. We need more information. Rose nodded agreement, and after a short discussion, everyone agreed, so we moved on to other things. I stood up. For now, we have a number of things we can do. Matthew, you and Gary need to come up with a plan for these antennae he mentioned. Ring gates will probably solve the distance problem, but I want you 2 to determine what locations to build the antennae, and I'll need a detailed accounting of what materials and support you'll need. Elaine, I want you to work with Gary as well. See if you can create a veil that only blocks the signals that Ansys uses if you can. Then perhaps we can ward the castle in such a way to create a dead zone for them here. Connell, I need you to go to Arundel. Tell George he needs to come here. It's no longer safe for us to be in separate locations. I want as many mages as possible here so we can watch and guard one another. The last thing we need is for something like what almost happened to Rose to happen to one of us. Moira.
I know,
she said with a smirk.
Spellbeasts. You want as many as possible, and you want them stationed with the guards and in Washbrook to help make certain Ansys doesn't get a foothold here.
It was disconcerting having a daughter who could read my mind almost at will, despite whatever mental barriers I'd put up. I grimaced, but let it go. Then I added, I'd like 1 or 2 in Albemarle also. The Queen will be staying with us much of the time, but she will have to be there during the day, and I don't want to leave Ariadne unguarded.
Graham, you've personally been host to one of Ansys's bugs before. We've kept a lot of that information quiet to avoid a panic, but you need to have a discussion with Captain Draper. Tell him everything you know. I want the two of you to prepare our guards for this threat. They have to know what to expect. Rose, you and Carissa are moving. You'll live with us. Your apartment is unlivable at present, and I don't like the thought of you being anywhere without appropriate protection. Connell put a hand up.
Dad, I don't think we have enough room.
Then we'll make room. Linerala can construct an additional...